Hello, everyone. It is lovely to be here. Justin and I were just talking about our links with this church. I got married here, and Justin, you were here for something with cadets?
Yeah, I was in the air cadets at Crowborough Training Camp, yes.
Okay. We've got interviews every night of these four nights. The whole thing really is being based around these John's Gospels. So when I speak, I'll be referring to this record of Jesus' life. And the Gospel ends talking about how those who put their trust in Jesus have life in his name. And I guess part of the point of the interviews is to see actually the reality of that in people's lives and in their experiences. And Justin, you've got a really interesting story for us. We've talked on the phone. We haven't met properly before this evening. Tell us a little bit, first of all, about, you know, where you live, kids, that sort of thing.
I live in Tunbridge. I go to Tunbridge Baptist Church. And my children are in Derbyshire.
Okay, and two boys, is it?
Two boys. I actually got three boys. It's a bit complicated. But two boys, 6 and 8, and Harry, who is 15.
Okay, we're comparing the ages of our children earlier. Now, some people will know your mum, actually, won't they? Perhaps that's not the best way of interviewing you. Who's your mum? How will they know your mum?
I've got a lovely mum. I know we all have. Jennifer Rees-Larkham is my mum.
Yeah, so she's well known for books and her faith as well. So tell us a little bit about your upbringing, because it's been a roller coaster, hasn't it? You call it riches to rags to reconciliation.
Yes.
So what was life like for you growing up?
I grew up in a Christian home. I had five brothers and sisters. So I really needed to find my own faith. And I did that in my teens. I had a very strong relationship with God, and right the way through my early years of work and through university, I had quite a close walk with God.
And both your mum and dad were committed Christians as well,
yes.
Were they? And so they were sort of raising you in what they believed?
Yes, and I think for those of us who grow up in Christian homes, we need to find our own faith. You know, I used to get dragged along to church on Sundays, and naturally I moved away from the church that my parents went to find my own. So I wasn't just going along with the family anymore.
No.
I was going because I wanted to go to church.
Yeah. So how old were you when that started to happen?
I'd made a commitment to Christ really early on in my life, but I guess in my teens. We moved from Mayfield to Tunbridge Wells, and it was in Tunbridge Wells that I found my own church.
Yeah, sure. So you left school 18.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about what happened then. So you went into the army?
I went to university first for 4 years, but then I started my military career at the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. And I can remember the day I drove through the gates and everyone was walking around with ironing boards.
Okay.
And yeah, so.
Oh, yes, I get that.
Yeah.
I'm an ex policeman. I remember those days of ironing in the creases. I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay. And that was fulfilling an ambition for me. I actually wanted to fly. And having been in the air cadets over here, my ambition was to fly. And for some crazy reason, the army said that they would train me to learn to fly, teach me to fly.
Okay. So, what was faith like for you in those days in the army? I can't imagine it's easy being a Christian.
There's one particular time when I talk about really living in the light. And actually, when I was at Sandhurst, my mum gave me a lovely little book. Some of you may have seen it. It's a small devotional called Living Light. And it's just some verses. At the beginning of it, she gave it to me and she said, Justin, you might not have a chance to read your Bible every day, but I hope you'll read this. Armies march on their stomachs, but as a Christian and an officer, you'll be responsible for the souls of your soldiers. It was a lovely thing to give me. And I was living in the light. Mm-hmm. And within a couple of days of arriving at Sandhurst, I made the decision, quite a difficult decision, actually. They teach you at Sandhurst never to stand out. Be a grey man. They say, don't do anything badly. Whatever you do, don't do anything well. On this one occasion, I used to love playing rugby, and it was the rugby trial. And they told us that if anyone gets selected to play in the academy, first 15, you get Wednesdays off training. So all 411 people in my intake turned up to the rugby trial. And because there were so many of us, the rugby trial that was on a Saturday spilled over into Sunday. And I made the decision. I walked up to this huge great colonel with a sideburns and even had a monocle. And I looked up and I said, sir, I can't play rugby today. I'm a Christian and I want to go to chapel. And he let me do that. And I didn't get selected to play in the first 15, but I was a reserve. And I went on after 2 minutes because the person in my position got injured. and I played the best game of rugby I'd ever played. They made me captain of that side, and I think because of that, I was awarded the Queen's Sword of Honour for graduating top of my intake. So I really made a stand for my faith early on. It's not an easy place to be a Christian, but soldiers are lovely. They will always talk about faith.
Yeah, yeah. So you were in the army for how long?
I spent 8.5 years
in the army. And what, you know, how were you serving when you were in there? What sort of things were you up to?
Well, my ambition to fly had a little bit of a problem. I couldn't actually land. And that is relatively important when you... So flying was quite good, actually. I was all right at that. But anyway, the day came when they said, Justin, you can't... Before you kill yourself or someone else, you need to find another regiment to go to. So I had a few anger issues to deal with, John, and I decided... Someone had told me that if I joined the Royal Artillery, they shot aeroplanes down. Okay. So I felt much better when I joined.
That was the best place to be.
I had, 8.5 years. For 2 months, I was the youngest major in the British Army. I served in Northern Ireland and I served in Bosnia. I had a great time and did the All Arms Commando course, which was great fun, and jumped out of aeroplanes.
Great. Yeah. So you left the Army then, and then you went into business. Tell us a little bit about your sort of career in business.
So I went from leading 460 men on a high-pressure operational tour to Bosnia to being the junior office clerk in a little office in Hertfordshire. But I was very ambitious. I was 30 years old, and I was desperate to catch up with everyone else. So I stayed behind after they'd all gone to work, and at 9 o'clock at night, there's no one really in the office apart from the cleaners and the managing director. And he kind of sat down next to me and occasionally asked me what I was doing. And within 2 years, I was promoted and was one of the youngest managing directors of a division of a global financial services company, working in the city, six-figure salary, married to the girl of my dreams, owned her own house, nice holidays, nice car, but...
Things started to go wrong.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a point of interest for us. Before we get into that, though, what was driving you? So in the army and then in business, what was lying behind your kind of
that
success?
That is such
there?
A good question. I was really driven. And I think... I didn't know any of this. I mean, if you'd asked me... You know, why did your life turn out like it did? I would have said, I'm just fine. I had a normal upbringing, a normal childhood, nothing different. I didn't have any pain. Actually, I did have pain. And I was driven right from a really early age when I competed in junior swimming championships and then in the army and in the city. I always had to try and be the best. And when I wasn't the best, I would pretend to be the best. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe... It goes back to a time when I was 13 years old in Tunbridge Wells. My dad came into my room one evening and he said, your mum's not going to last the night. We've said goodbye to her. The doctors have said she's not going to respond to the medication. So I said goodbye and I'm telling you now. Mm. When I woke up in the morning, and I obviously didn't sleep that much, I was different. 13 years old, all the way through my life, my mum had been there. She'd been my security. She'd been my friend. She'd picked me up and taken me to Pembury Hospital in the Kent, Sussex, when it was still a hospital, to get my bones fixed. And she was always there. And then one night, I suddenly realised that even people that we love can abandon us. So I think I was driven to try and succeed because I measured my worth on how people perceived me and how successful I appeared to be.
Yeah, okay, that's very helpful for us in terms of where we're going. And what place did Christ have? You know, you've grown up, you're a believing Christian.
Yeah.
What place did Christ have for you in the army and then in business, particularly as things you were starting to be very successful? Did things wane a little bit?
That was the issue. Mm-hmm. There was nothing deliberate. I never stopped believing in God. I never reached a point where I said, oh, that's all rubbish. I always had my faith. But one day, I guess, I just said to the Lord, thanks very much. I've got a six-figure salary now. I've made it in business. I've got a lovely wife. I can take it from here. Thanks for all you've done so far, but I'm all right now. And I stopped living in the light. I stopped reading my Bible. I stopped reading that little devotional that I'd read all my life. And I put it in a drawer. And I made excuses. I'd moved up to Derbyshire to be close to my wife and her family business. I said, there's no good churches where I live, so that's okay. And, you know, I've got a six-hour commute there and back, or 3 hours down to London, 3 hours back, 5 days a week. I don't have time for a quiet time. And I just pushed him away.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting, isn't it? So there's that sense of achievement, and with that then comes a sense of self-reliance. You know, yes. I've managed this all on my own. I don't need him.
Yeah.
But obviously you were then very soon to find out how much you did need him. So tell us then how things went wrong from that point.
Well, it was catastrophe for me saying, I'm all right, I could do it on my own now. Our lovely son, Matthew, who was 11 months, we began to notice that he wasn't using his right hand. And I said to Emma, you think it's odd? She said, oh, no, we've got left-handed people in our family, he'll just be left-handed. Mm-hmm. And then one day I listened to, on my drive into the station, I listened to this interview with a footballer who said they'd had an 11-month-old daughter and they noticed that she was favouring her left hand, not really using her right hand. They'd taken her to see a consultant and got a diagnosis for something called right-side hemiplegia. It was a form of cerebral palsy. Their daughter had a stroke when she was born or around about that time, and she now had limited movement down her right side. I went home that night and I said to Em, we've got to take Matthew to have, you know, see a consultant. Mm-hmm. So we did, and he got this diagnosis, and I saw a picture of a scan of his brain with a great big scar on it. And it knocked me for six. Mm-hmm. And then as we left the consultant's office, she said, oh, by the way, your son may well go on to develop epilepsy. And just 1 week later, he was in my arms. It was a hot day. I was holding him, and his arm started to jerk. And I knew that he was having a fit. I just didn't know what to do. I did everything wrong. I put him in the car, and I put my arms around him to try and come. And he'd had a fit because of a very sharp peak in his temperature, a febrile fit. I should have just loosened off his clothing. And he actually turned blue, and I couldn't feel any breathing. His lips were a dark shade of purple. I was giving him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And for the first time in months, I prayed. Mm. I just said, please, God, I don't want to lose my son. Around the corner came our next-door neighbour, who was a retired surgeon. He stepped in and took over and kept Matthew alive. Matthew went off to the hospital, and he was okay. But that knocked me for six. So here I was, someone who'd pushed God away. I'd reached a bit of a plateau in my job. I'd been passed over for a promotion for the first time. I was trying to come to terms with the fact that my son was severely disabled. And it was kind of like the perfect storm. And then one Saturday, just a week after that happened, I was watching a game of rugby, and I noticed one of those many, many adverts that we see for a £5 free bet. I put my £5 down that I needed to get this free bet, and I won. And I often wonder what would have happened if I'd lost that bet. Because I think I'd have just got my laptop and closed it down and thought, what a waste of time. But I didn't. And I somehow didn't feel right. But after that, I began to get more and more engaged with gambling.
And what was driving that?
It's a really good question. And at the time, I wouldn't have had a clue. But I think, you know, I'd had this career in the army where I jumped out of airplanes, and you know, and now I was kind of in a bit of a plateau at work. Long commute down to London and back every 5 days, driven by the need just to earn money, mm-hmm. not by a desire or enjoyment for my work. And then coming to terms with the fact that our son wasn't well. It was, I just didn't even think. I got my laptop, and I gambled for the first time in my life.
And how did that then develop? Because obviously things got a lot more serious. How did that work for you, that the one bet led to one more and then more and more and more?
Well, I wasn't an instant gambling addict. You know, I was completely in control of what I was doing. I just kind of enjoyed it. I began to engage a bit more with sport. I got my excitement that maybe I was missing from gambling, and over the course of 6 months, you know, there were small bets, but I suddenly worked out that I was losing more often than I was winning, and I worked out how much I'd lost. It was about £700. That made me angry, because I'm an optimist. I'm expecting to win. I'm a bad loser as well, and I'm very competitive. So those things aren't good, and one day I worked out how much I'd lost, and I put £1,000 down to win everything back in one go, thinking I'll win all my money back and then I'll close this computer down for good. And of course, I lost that bet. Mm-hmm. And then things changed, because I'd stepped over the line. I wasn't just someone who occasionally had a flutter. I was someone who was betting serious amounts of money In secret. And that's a really important thing, too. I was doing it all in secret.
So your wife didn't know anything
Not
about
a clue.
This.
Mm. Not a clue.
And was it constantly, then, these two things, the excitement at one level and the desire to get back?
Yes. And the problem was that as my gambling debts got worse and worse, I chased after it harder until we got to the stage where I was very heavily in debt. Mm. We'd spent all our money. In fact, the house that we'd owned, we'd sold because Emma thought that my mood swings, I was up here when I was winning and down here most of the time when I was losing, were because we lived in a town. So we moved out to the country, moved into a rental property, put the equity from the sale of our house into my accounts. And, yeah, that's when it got really quite serious.
Yeah.
And this is... The trouble with gambling is that to get the same amount of buzz, of high, if you like, you have to bet more and more riskily, more and more extremely bigger and bigger amounts. And the problem, again, is that you create this horrible world. It was a horrible world of debt. If Emma had known that I got ourselves into so much debt... So I was kind of escaping from the reality, and the stupid thing was, because of my own pride, I didn't get the help I needed. I didn't ask for help. I just thought, that's okay, I'll win everything back, cover everything up, and it'll be all right.
Now, for people to get a bit of a feel of how bad it got, can you give us a sense of what you ended up losing and where this took you?
Well, because I was only accountable to myself... in the course of 3 years, I lost £750,000. Mm-hmm. I lost my job because I used my corporate card, which was absolutely insane. But I didn't tell my wife that I had lost my job. I carried on pretending to go to work, and I began selling things in the house. So I lost in the end. I lost. Emma left when she found out, and she was right to leave. I was self-destructing. Mm. She took the boys with her, and it reached the point where I was almost suicidal, living off a sack of mouldy potatoes, couldn't afford to heat the house, hadn't paid the rent for 5 months. When my mum came back with my brother, came up to Derbyshire and said, "You're about to be evicted. Your father-in-law's paid off the rent arrears. He wants you out. You can walk the streets, or you can come back to Kent and try and get some recovery."
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, hearing this, just seeing in practice how one thing leads to another. You know, the gambling leads to the deception.
Yes.
The deception leads to the broken relationships.
Yeah.
And slowly things start to unravel and be lost. Mm. Tell us a little bit then about how you then experienced God intervene and, you know, bring you back. Because, you know, that is rock bottom. How do you get to where you are now? You know, what happened?
I came to my senses that night. I'd been completely humiliated, which meant my pride was gone. Which I'm so grateful to God for the humiliation, because when the pride was gone, I sought help, the help that I needed. I walked around the house collecting my last bits and pieces, some clothes, some pictures, and I had a bin liner worth of possessions and £73,000 worth of debt. Mm. But I finally came to my senses back home in Kent, in the spare room that I'd left when I was 18, got down on my knees and I prayed. A really simple prayer. I just prayed, "God, forgive me for what I've done. Come back into my life and heal me if you can." And he did.
Mm-hmm. Am I right that was the last... You've not gambled since then, since that moment?
Not only that, but incredibly, I felt no temptation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost as though that person died. That person, I literally, by the grace of God, he transformed me. I became someone very different, with different priorities. And all of a sudden, my priorities were my family and friends and time with people and reading the Bible. And I replaced my addiction for gambling and all my thoughts and all my energy going into gambling with a desire to live in the light again.
Yeah.
And as I read the Bible and replaced the gambling with life as a Christian again, God really came in and he healed me.
Yeah.
He healed me on the outside. So he stopped me. All my triggers were gone and we put some blocks in place. Mm-hmm. But then he had to heal me on the inside. That took a bit longer. And it wasn't until a newspaper article I finally decided that I would stand up and talk about the fact that gambling does actually have a negative side, despite 11% of every advert on TV is a gambling advert now. They've, in terms of real terms, they've gone up 1,400% since 2007. And I wanted to say, actually, there's a downside to it for 500,000 people. Here's my story. So on the 17th of August 2013, 5 million people read a double-page spread of how an ex-army officer could lose £750,000 over 3 years and everything else. And when I read that, I thought, oh, no. What have I done? I've just told the world what an idiot I am. But that is when Christ set me free from the inside.
That, can you articulate why? You know, what is it that's going on there? What was he setting you free from?
I no longer had to pretend. Mm-hmm. I could just be me. Justin Rees-Larkham, someone who is far from perfect. In fact, someone who's actually flawed, but loved completely by God. Mm. And that love he has for me, he couldn't love me anymore, no matter what I do. So I don't have to pretend anymore to be good at things to get that feeling of love. I felt his love. And I also felt there was nothing I could do that would he would take his love away. I just felt loved by him and by his grace forgiven. Mm. And that really set me free.
It's interesting, even listening to this, here's Justin, army major, you know, upstanding guy, talking about the love of God, which isn't a very blokey thing to talk about, but actually so liberating, because what I'm hearing from you is then there isn't that need to prove yourself to others because you are accepted and you know your maker. We're thinking a bit later on, one of the statements of Jesus that we'll be mentioning is, do not work for food that spoils, but for food that endures to eternal life, which he, the Son of Man, will give. What have those sort of ideas meant to you in this whole journey?
Fundamentally, for me, as a Christian guy, it's about priorities. Mm-hmm. When I put God first, things seem to work. And if I could, I'd share just a really quick analogy of how that works out. As an addict, your self-esteem is very low. And I actually wanted to try and do something about that. So as well as recommitting my life to Christ, I began to swim again. And like a true addict, rather than just going up and down, I decided I'd try and swim the channel. So in September the 7th, 2014, I started out across the channel, and after 10 hours, everything was fine. My pilot had said to me, all you've got to do, Justin, is stay by the boat. And I did. I stayed right the way through the boat, and then something catastrophic happened. I saw France. And I suddenly thought, I've done it. I can make it. I don't need my pilot anymore. I can see where I'm going. I'll just swim over there. And so I carried on. And it got dark, and the waves came, had a 15-knot wind. And with waves, I began to take on more and more seawater. I couldn't see. It was dark. I turned my head to get a breath. I actually got salt water. So my throat was closing up. My tongue was expanding. I could feel my shoulders going. And all the time, I was drifting further away from the boat. Because what the pilot was trying to do is get me around the back of Cap Grenet and offset the boat for a 4-knot tide. I just thought he was going the wrong way. Yeah. I was ending towards Belgium. And then finally the penny dropped when they got a light and they shone it down by the side of the boat. And I suddenly realised they want me to swim in this patch of light. Mm-hmm. So I made the effort. I swam back. And when I got there, I got shelter from the lee of the boat, from the wind. And the waves were still there. But now when I turned my head, I could see them. And so I stopped taking on board the salt water. They gave me a triple strength carb drink, which was brilliant, and they encouraged me. And I got to France 2 hours, 40 minutes later. And that's just like my life.
Yeah.
When I go off and try and do my own thing and don't take on that spiritual nourishment, I really suffer.
Yeah.
But when I'm living my life where he wants me to be, eating the food that he wants me to eat, he takes me on the purpose and the path that he has for me.
That's so helpful, isn't it, to a parable of where you've been. My guess is amongst this group here, there might be some that are struggling with addictions, but there's a lot of people here who probably think, you know, that's great, but their thing is that they are nevertheless going it alone. You know, they don't see that need of Christ. What What would you have to say from your story to those people?
I would say that the fundamental thing is to live an honest life. And that means by not wearing those masks that we wear, by not pretending to be the people that we think we want people to be, just to be secure in the love of Christ and to live in the light. For us as Christians, to protect our spiritual health. If we protect our spiritual health, if we do the right things when we wake up in the morning, we spend time with Christ, we pray, we talk to him, we have a healthy relationship, we don't have the need to fill our lives with other things. I really believe that we've all been made to have a fulfilling life with Christ, walking hand in hand with him. And if we don't have that, then we start filling our lives with other stuff. And very often for an addiction, and it's difficult to talk about addiction in church because people don't really like to talk about that, but if we talk about secret habits or compulsions or even sins, if we keep going back to those, it's probably because we've got a pain in our lives, inside us, that's not being fulfilled.
Yeah.
And the wonderful thing about being a Christian is it can be fulfilled by Christ.
Yeah. And the striking thing hearing that is the role of humility in that, that actually for you there was that need to be brought low.
Yes.
And I've often thought, in fact myself, when I became a Christian, that need to see that actually you do need Christ. Because it's so easy to think you can just go it alone. And sometimes we get little hints of how much we need him. Now, there is a story I wanted you to share before we close, which hasn't come up. I just think it's such a special one in terms of the Lord's provision. Tell us a little bit about the journey of your sword.
Yeah. Well, I sold my sword, at the one that the Queen gave me, at the height of my addiction. It took me 3 attempts to go into the shop, and I cried when I left the shop, because that represented everything that was good. I got £200 for it, and when I'd lost that money, I phoned the shop up and I said, "I've made a terrible mistake. I gave you something to sell. I need to get it back." And the shop owner said, "We've just sold it. We've got no record of where it's gone." And for 3 years, it was gone. And occasionally, I'd go online and see if I could find it, and maybe it would turn up. I was convinced it had maybe gone to America. And then the day before Christmas Eve, I had a phone call from...
This was the Christmas Eve after you'd come back.
This was 3 years after I'd sold the sword.
Yeah.
I was back down here.
Yeah. And you'd gone back to Christ.
Restored. Mm-hmm. Everything was beginning to come back.
Yeah.
I had a call from one of the newspapers that had run one of the stories. They'd been contacted by someone who had some information about my sword. And they gave me a website, and I went on the website and I saw it. And I knew it was mine because it had my name on it. and that's how they'd found it, because they Googled my name. If you Google Justin Rees-Lye, you come up with all sorts of stuff. And it came back, got FedEx down to me. And the next day, Christmas Eve, God brought back my sword of honour.
Yeah.
And that, I'm so grateful to him.
But what another parable that is. You know, you call your story riches to rags to reconciliation, and that... It struck me when we were talking earlier, you know, losing that sword in some ways was the loss of your life, all that was there. And with the return of that sword was Christ's restoration by his great mercy and love. Justin, thank you so much for sharing all that
thank
with
you.
Us. It must still be something that takes quite a lot to open up about. Should we show our appreciation?
Oh, thank you.